Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Brian J. Cramp is from Waukesha. He was raised right across the street from the Sunset Bowl bowling alley. This is where veteran record producer Jack Douglas discovered the Rockford, Illinois band Cheap Trick. So it's only fitting that Brian is now the author of a hefty book about Cheap Trick's early years. Yeah, he could have written a book about the early years of the Sunset Bowl, but that wouldn't have been nearly as interesting. Cheap Trick has been around for almost a half century, but their music still sounds as fresh and vital as ever, according to Brian. His book, This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick, makes a very strong case for why Cheap Trick might be one of the best rock bands ever. Beta's resident musicologist, Steve Gotcher, asked Brian how he came up with that title.
So on the inner sleeve of their first album, there's basically a fake biography written by Eric Van Lusbauder, who ended up becoming a pretty famous writer. He took over the Jason Bourne series when Robert Ludlum passed away, and he worked for Epic at the time, and he wrote this basically kind of a farcical biography of the band, and that's the first line, the first sentence of that printed on one entire side of the inner sleeve of the first album is that biography.
Yeah, because obviously your book demonstrates that this band has quite a past.
Yeah, I really like that title for different reasons, but the idea that it's, you know, kind of humorous because, yeah, the entire book is about their past.
Your book ends its history after the release of the third record. Why did you decide to stop there?
The plan was to end it right before Budokan was about to come out and break big in the United States. Kind of the big cliffhanger. And then basically everybody knows what happens after that.
Early on, Rick Nielsen and Tom Peterson were part of a band called the Grim Reapers, and then they later became Fuse. What was that band like?
Well, that was Rick's first band. His very first band was called the Phaetons, but that was short-lived, and that's what turned into the Grim Reapers. The band existed for a couple of years before Tom Peterson actually joined, and they were exclusively a cover band. And eventually they had two different singers and they would play a mix of kind of rock and roll and soul music. And they were high schoolers. But when Tom Peterson joins, Tom had a band called Toast and Jam with Craig Myers and Chip Greenman. And those three guys were like amazing musicians and they played really well together. And when Rick Nielsen saw that band, he had already been thinking about converting the Grim Reapers to a band that played originals, because that was really kind of the way to go if you wanted to make a career of it. And so when he saw Toast and Jam, he decided he wanted those guys for his band. And really, basically, Rick joined Toast and Jam, but then they used the Grim Reapers name just because it had more, they could get better bookings and it had more notoriety. So there's really two completely different bands that were called the Grim Reapers. And the one with Tom Peterson was really Rick joining Toast and Jam and then changing the name. And then that of course, is the band that became Fuse.
Did Rick and Tom's experience in that band contribute in any way to what Cheap Trick would become?
I don't think so, beyond just, you know, they had so much experience playing shows night after night, even before they were in Cheap Trick. So by the time all those guys came together as Cheap Trick, they were already such seasoned musicians and experienced performers. But if you listen to the Fuse album, there's really not even a hint of what was to come with Cheap Trick. I mean, they were all teenagers when they recorded that record. And I think it took Rick Nielsen a while to figure out his songwriting style. And a lot of the bands that would influence what Cheap Trick became didn't even exist when he was his first foray into writing original songs with the Grim Reapers and Fuse.
What is it about Cheap Trick that checks so many boxes for rock music fans?
You know, they were punk before punk. They were metal before metal. They were in 74, 75, 76, they were writing and performing these songs that at the time were really adventurous and crazy and experimental and unique. And they incorporated so many different influences.
Hello, kiddies, what
So I'm a huge record collector and rock fan, and the music I love, which is like hard rock, heavy metal, punk rock, power pop, glam rock, Cheap Trick was kind of all of that. And there really isn't another band that quite straddled as many of the subgenres as Cheap Trick did. And also, they were funny and kind of satirical, self-deprecating, all these different elements that you could really appreciate on so many different levels. Cheap Trick were never even close to pretentious. Cheap Trick could appeal to everybody from Stiff Records to Trouser Press, to all these kind of guys loved them, but then they could go on tour with Kiss and all the Kiss fans would love them. There weren't really many bands that could pull that off, that could appeal to the kind of the elite and kind of the underground, almost alternative scene, like Stiff wanted to put out their first album, or Bomp Records, an indie label in California, loved them. But then at the same time, they were out on tour with Kansas.
Yeah, they really didn't seem like a band that took themselves too seriously. I mean, I'm thinking of the song Hello There, where they have two lines in the song, and then they come in with these rock power chords that make the song such a great rock and roll song, but so simple.
Yeah, and when you look like Cheap Trick looked, there's always that kind of element of almost satire that helps get that kind of thing across to where it doesn't seem ridiculous.
Now, you mentioned that they had a lot of influences, but I'm wondering if there are any particular bands that influenced them the most.
Well, obviously, The Move and Roy Wood always get referenced, but that's the thing. They have so many different styles incorporated that they sound like so many different bands from song to song. But, you know, if you listen to a band like Sensational Alex Harvey Band, you will really hear the Cheap Trick influence. But then you listen to Sparks and you really hear it there as well. And these were oddball bands, and these were bands that were far better known in Europe than over here. This was the kind of stuff that Rick Nielsen really picked up on and appreciated and, you know, incorporated some of these kind of eccentricities into his own songwriting, but he really had his own unique kind of style that he developed.
Some people only know Cheap Trick from their hits and think of them as kind of like one-hit wonders. Now, if you had a chance to pick a record that demonstrates the band's depth and would change someone's mind, what would it be?
Well, the first album is a brilliant piece of work. It's a wonderful document of that early club band, because Jack Douglas seemed to pick all of their weirdest, most abrasive songs for the most part. I mean, they had I Want You to Want Me and Surrender ready to go for the first album, but Jack Douglas took it in a completely different direction, but ended up kind of giving us a time capsule of what it was like to see Cheap Trick in the clubs. But the first record is very different from what was going to come later. So, you know, an album like Heaven Tonight is more of a, I think, a representation of both sides of Cheap Trick, with the more melodic pop material and some of the heavy abrasive stuff like Auf Wiedersehen, which is another song they had for the first album that would have fit really well on the first album. Wiedersehen is a great example of Cheap Trick's kind of crazy, abrasive material. But then I think a song like On Top of the World is maybe the best example of just how great a songwriter Rick Nielsen was.
You're on top of the world, you're on top of the world tonight. It was
yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example of to play for someone so they could understand exactly how great of a band they were and how great the songs were.
So with Cheap Trick being from Rockford, Illinois, you'd think that they'd be more associated with Chicago, but instead they appear to have roots in Wisconsin and a lot of the rural Midwest, Iowa, and rural Illinois. Why is that?
Well, that's how they were making a living for a couple of years there, was just playing that whole circuit of bars and clubs in Illinois and Wisconsin. And Ken Adamany was originally from Janesville, and he was always based in Madison. And he was booking shows ever since the late 50s when he had his own band. And all through the 60s, Ken Adamany, you know, at one point he had over 100 bands on his roster that he was booking shows for. So he had developed this entire circuit, and he could just keep the band working every night of the week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they would play almost every night. And, you know, they were making a decent living. And, you know, they took their time before they really started trying to break in Chicago. They were more of a Madison or a Milwaukee band than a Chicago band. You know, that's where their following was. That's where they played a lot more than they ever really played in Chicago at the time.
One of the stories that I found really quite interesting was the story about the Cheap Trick logo, how that came into being.
Christopher Crow was such a great guy to talk to because he's so articulate. He's a writer himself, and he was inspired to design that logo all on his own just because he loved the band so much. So they didn't even know he was doing it. And it's such an iconic, amazing logo that has contributed, I think, so much to their image and just the vibe, the mystique of the band. He ran it through multiple different processes, just overkill on purpose. When I talked to Paula Scher, who designed the first album cover, she kind of designed the album cover around the logo because she really loved what he was doing. She said it was a joke about reproduction. And when I talked to Chris about that, he was like, yeah, I guess that's right, but I didn't really think about it at the time. But it's kind of like Carrie Baker described it as a secretary typing it over and over right before a brutal suicide or something. It's like making the letters bleed. And he used these different processes to kind of distort it, but it was done manually. It was done physically, organically, and then just handed to the band at a club on just like a piece of cardstock.
So the band finally breaks and they go to Japan and they are received like the Beatles there. What is it that made them so popular in Japan?
Well, I think it's definitely the music. You know, the Japanese loved hard rock and glam rock at the time. So Cheap Trick was kind of the best of both worlds in that sense. And also just the image of the band, they were kind of cartoonish. I think the Japanese loved that. They have the funny guys and they have the heartthrobs. I mean, you know, so they just can appeal on multiple levels in multiple ways. It doesn't seem surprising that the Japanese in the 70s really got on board with Cheap Trick.
Live album, Cheap Trick at Budokan, became a huge hit for the band, but the story goes that they never really wanted to release it.
You know, it was recorded originally because they were so popular in Japan, so the label just wanted to put it out in Japan, you know, not really expecting that it would sell in America. And so the band didn't really pay a lot of attention to it. I know they didn't like the cover. The idea was it might be a double album. Then it was reduced to a single album. I think the band they weren't huge on the idea of a live album at the time, but they were willing to just have this thing for the fans in Japan. But then when it started really selling as an import, the label kind of picked up on that and wanted to put it out. And it's not like the band tried to stop them or anything, but it wasn't the band's idea And I don't think it was really the direction the band envisioned going at the time, but obviously it ended up being a huge blessing in disguise.
I ran across some music on YouTube, and this isn't really covered in your book, but in 1980, Rick and Bunny, along with bassist Tony Levin, recorded a version of I'm Losing You for John Lennon's Double Fantasy album. And I don't know if you've heard it, but the version is absolutely fantastic, but it wasn't used on the record.
Here in some stranger's room, late in the afternoon, what am I doing here at all? Oh, ain't no doubt about it, I'm losing you.
How did that session come about, if you know, and why didn't that version make it on the album?
Yeah, it is great, and I have no idea why it didn't make it on the album. I mean, Jack Douglas was producing that, so that's how it came about. He mentioned it to John and then invited Rick and Bunny to come to a session. Rick talks about how that was the night he was playing with for John Lennon was the night that Dax Nielsen was born. So he missed Dax's birth to play with John Lennon.
How do you think Cheap Trick is going to be remembered in rock and roll history?
You know, it was amazing to see them get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm so glad that they got that recognition. And that just comes from all their peers who love them. I mean, that's the thing is they've always been the band's band. I mean, almost every guy in every band from the 80s and the 90s loved Cheap Trick. All the hair metal guys and all the grunge guys and everybody in between. For all of those guys, you know, they are one of the quintessential bands. That's probably the most important thing is they have such great respect from their peers and from the critics and from the big rock fans.
Well, Brian Cramp, thanks a lot for spending some time with me today. Your book is, I'm going to call it, The Definitive History of Cheap Trick. This band has no past. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Steve.
Brian J. Cramp is the author of This Band Has No Past, How Cheap Trick Became Cheap Trick. Steve Gotcher talked to him. Find out more about Cheap Trick at WPR.org/beta.
He says, well, you know, I see four Jews here, and I think we need a black person because of all the scenes with this, black sheriff.
Coming up, Patrick McGilligan joins us to talk about Mel Brooks' 1974 Western comedy, Blazing Saddles. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.